of a reason to go there. In my travels around the world, I speak at universities everywhere, and I find this theme of spiritual economics it taps into a lot of interest. Why is that? Maybe 20, 30, or even as recently as 10 years ago, there was an automatic thought, a knee-jerk reaction, reflex action, that the more the economy grows, the more people have money, the happier they'll be. But this assumption is under great attack now. The past 15 years or so has seen the rise of the academic field known as the science of happiness. Back in the 90s, this social science was just beginning. Now it has Nobel Prize winners. And, okay, you can do me a favor, just the cell phones. You can, thank you. So for the past 5 years, 10 years or so, the science of happiness is quite reputable. As I said, it has Nobel Prize winners. The conclusions that this new social science presents are quite striking and quite important for you as an individual and for society as a whole. Some of the findings of this new science of happiness. Number one, beyond a basic middle-class standard of living, any further increase in your income or luxuries does not lead to an increase in happiness or life satisfaction as measured by standard psychological indicators. This conclusion is no longer debated in essence. Simply, there are arguments about the fine points, but the basic conclusion is accepted worldwide now. For example, you look at nations that have quintupled their GDP, and you don't see any increase in life satisfaction as measured by standard psychological indicators. You look at Japan, you look at the USA, you look at the UK. All the information is the same with minor variance. You don't see any increase in happiness as measured by psychologists. And in fact, you may see a dip, a little decrease. So at best, you see a flat line. No growth in happiness, although the economy has grown by 5 times. And sometimes you see even a little dip. So what does that tell us as intelligent human beings who are concerned with our individual well-being, who are concerned with the well-being of society? This conclusion has enormous implications. But then again, we have to ask ourselves, do we have the integrity and control of our mind and senses to apply this research conclusion? I was speaking at UCT, University of Cape Town, and it's said to be the premier institution on the African continent. I guess maybe Mauritius is exempt because it's in between two continents. So, I asked the students, 200 students, including professors, gathered there for my talk. I asked them, are you aware of this research conclusion presented by the Science of Happiness, which includes Nobel Prize winning? Are you aware that no matter how you try to increase your income, opulence, luxuries, beyond a basic middle class standard, you will not increase your life satisfaction, you will not increase your happiness as measured by standard psychological indicators? Out of 200, almost everyone raised their hands. Yes, we are aware of it. After all, it's this University of Cape Town, they're supposed to be aware of these things. They were aware. They acknowledge there are minor variations and fine-tunings and contestings of small points, but the basic proposition is not argued. So I said, all right, almost all 200 of you are aware of this, students and professors. Now tell me, please answer this question, how many of you are prepared to live life simply on a basic middle-class standard? What do you think happened? Maybe 2 or 3 out of 200 raised their hand. Should I ask you the question? You might usher me off the campus. But, all right, I won't ask you, but just think internally. Are you going to the university here just to live a basic middle class life? Can I ask the question, or I should? All right, let me ask. How many of you here are going to this university just with the goal of living a basic middle-class standard of life? Raise your hands. You were raising, or just holding the check? So just see, there is a disconnect. There's a disconnect between our intelligence and our knowledge, even knowledge that's taught at the university, and what we're going to do. And then we wonder, oh, why is the world the way it is? Why are people so confused? And why is the world so confused? Why can't our leaders, yeah, the leaders, why can't they do something about it? Well, here you see where the problem begins. So, our leaders, national and international, are just dealing with the way people are, because it's those people who have elected them. So if the people cannot control their mind and senses, then what do you expect of the leaders? Persons who cannot control their mind and senses choose leaders who can't control their mind and senses, and the leaders, such leaders, feel obligated to make decisions that involve no mind and sense control, because that's the way the people are who elected them. So this way, things go on and on. So we're studying at the university, and what is our purpose? Is it to get wisdom, or is it to make money? Now, we're making a value-free statement at this point. We're just objectively looking at our motivations. It used to be said, and no longer do many people say it, that the purpose of getting higher education is to be, so you'll have wisdom, you'll have virtue, you'll be fully informed, because a democracy depends on wise persons who are fully informed, because they can vote based on wisdom. That's the theory. It used to be said like that in the past. Now, everyone understands the real conclusion, unveiled, undisguised, that the purpose of higher education is to help you make money. For example, in New Zealand, where I'm based some of the year, I'm both an American citizen and a New Zealand citizen. So in New Zealand, you look at the letterhead for the Ministry of Education, and it says right on the letterhead, their mission statement, the purpose of education is to enhance economic development. Now, no one argues that point anymore these days. In other words, forget the wisdom, forget the deep understandings. My studies have to lead to more money. More money means more success. Yet, what we may be studying in school, or should be studying in school, tells us that beyond a basic middle-class standard of living, any further increase in economic activity does not lead to increase in life satisfaction. So something is out of control here. There's a major disconnect. In other words, we're striving unnecessarily, uselessly. Now, no doubt, there are parts of the world that can use economic upliftment. There are parts of the world where people don't have the basic necessities of life. But there are also parts of the world where people have more than they can spend. Let's consider. Because you might be saying, all right, the developed countries, the so-called first world, they've had their day in the sun. They've had a chance to party. Now it's time for everyone else. So the developed world, the first world, has already wrecked the environment. So how can they dictate to the developing world that you should slow down, don't have so much economic advancement, it's polluting the atmosphere? That's why India, China, they don't listen. What do you mean? You had your chance, and now it's our turn, and you want to curb us. We want our citizens to get the money. In other words, we want all the problems that the first world has. We want, bring it on to us, give us our chance to have family breakdown, psychological problems. Do you know what is the fastest growing disease in the world? Who can say? Huh?
Stress.
Who knows? As measured by the WHO, World Health Organization, the fastest growing disease in the world is mental depression. It's right behind heart disease in terms of measured disease impact. There are different ways that you can gauge what is becoming the major disease. You can measure it in different ways. So this way, the WHO is measuring according to disease impact. I won't go into all the details of that. It's not necessary. Mental depression. And that is the prime, that's the number one export of the developed world to the developing world. Just like the USA, it said that its top exports are aircraft and movies. But there's something else that's also being passed on, that's being shipped. That is mental depression. And the numbers of those afflicted by mental depression are rising in the developing world as they adopt the feverish motivations of the first world. So where does this end? Is the path to success simply about madness? So in other words, what I'm speaking about is not simply a luxury matter for the developed world, the first world. Slow down, money's not everything. What I'm speaking about is also applicable, especially for the developing world. In other words, why repeat the same mistakes? Why try to reinvent the wheel, especially a wheel that's faulty and that causes accidents? Why not consider another direction? So the developing world has a better chance to do that sometimes it's argued, no, no, the developing world is not the place to speak about wisdom, speak about inner virtue, to speak about spiritual development. The developing world needs more money. So you take your message, please, to the first world. They've already had their share and more. In fact, they've had our share. Let them slow down. No, it's very difficult to teach an old dog new tricks. It's much easier to teach a young economy than to try to turn around an old economy. So therefore, I argue for the opposite. It's actually easier for the developing world to make changes. But they have to look ahead and see what's on that road of economic feverish development. What is the big fear in most people's mind? Scarcity. There's just not enough for everyone. And since there's not enough for everyone, I've got to compete to get my share. And a little more for security's sake. I've got to compete to get my share, and also so that my loved ones, my family and friends, I can help them in time of need. Everyone is afflicted by this paranoia of scarcity. It's been drummed into us since we were little children. You've got to become qualified to get your share. There's not enough in the world. You've got to become competitive. Just like often when I'm speaking at institutions in India, especially IIT, the question arises from the students. This spiritual science that you're advocating, the science of the soul and its connection to the Supreme Soul, this Krishna conscious knowledge, won't it reduce our competitiveness at the university and at the workplace? Because if we become too spiritual, we'll take our eyes off the road while driving in the race for material success. And we won't be effective anymore. There's that fear that if you become too spiritual, you'll not be able to cope with the world anymore. But I explained to them that, especially with this spiritual knowledge of India, you actually can deal with the world better. Scarcity is caused not by the problems of nature, but by the problems of human beings. So genuine spiritual knowledge can cure the human problem, and then there is no environmental problem. There is no resource problem. So what you are seeing today is a human problem. For example, a global organization, the Institute of Mechanical Engineers, has recently calculated that every year 1.2 billion tons of food are thrown away. And they've calculated, the Institute of Mechanical Engineers has calculated that 50%, that's 50% of the food produced in the whole world is tossed out, thrown away. Now, these are engineers. They're not yogis or sadhus making these statements. These are engineers. And they've used their engineering knowledge to make that calculation. That approximately 50% of the world's food production is discarded, thrown away. So again, you see, we have a human problem. Humans need higher consciousness. Otherwise, they have the unfortunate honor of becoming the first species to destroy its own habitat. One preeminent biologist, probably the most famous biologist of the 20th century, E.O. Wilson, Harvard emeritus now. He said, you take all, just consider all the various species that you know on Earth, as well as species you don't know. If you take out just one of those species, let's say ants, and you'll cause major reactions in the ecosphere. You'll cause damage to other parts of the ecosystem. Any species, no matter how insignificant you think that species is, you wipe it out, let it become extinct, they're chain reactions. Any species except one, and guess what that one is? If we get rid of the human beings, no problem. In fact, he calculated that strictly in terms of biomass, if you take all the human beings of the world, what's it about, 7 billion now, you could, this is a thought experiment, you know, just like Einstein did thought experiments, so this is a thought experiment. You could take all the human beings in the world and stack them like sardines in a box 1.3 miles cubic. And you could take that box, 1.3 cubic miles, and all the human beings are stacked in it like sardines. You can lower it into a remote section of the Grand Canyon in the USA. Gone. So in terms of biomass, human beings are so insignificant. And in fact, they're the only species that you can remove from nature without causing chain reactions, repercussions. So what does that tell you? It tells us that human beings are meant for a higher purpose than material interaction. Human beings are meant for enlightenment. They're meant for spiritual development. This is the message of the ancient Vedas. And we're seeing that message has enormous practical potential for dealing with the human problem today. So I explained how human beings have become a geophysical force and causing so much damage. Sometimes human beings are referred to today as weather makers, but more accurate would be to say they are weather wreckers. A geophysical force, for the first time in known human history, human beings can affect major damage on a huge natural scale. So we spoke about 50% of the food production in the world being discarded, tossed out. Now, how does that make you feel? So, wait a minute, there are people starving in the world. Or if they're not starving, they're working so hard just to feed themselves. And now we hear from the Institute of Mechanical Engineers that 50% of the world's food production is thrown away? Wait a minute, what's going on here? Why don't they throw the food my way? I don't have to work so hard. Well, consider things from another angle. There are approximately 1 billion persons who are starving. They don't get enough food to nourish themselves. 1 billion persons. And guess what? There are 1 billion persons who have obesity problems. So you see. Again, we have a human problem. Some are getting too much. Some are getting not enough. So how are we going to make a difference in the world? Because hopefully some of you, while having your plans for massive economic expansion, you also have some plans to do something for the world, hopefully. But how to make a change? During my years at Yale University, I thought about this very deeply. At that time, there was no science of happiness. So I discussed with my professors in my first year there. I said, I want to study something that solves the problems of the world at the deepest level. I want to find the greatest knowledge, the deepest truth. So they said, well, we're very happy to hear that. This is what the university is actually meant for. I explained to them, look, I don't want to be pinned down by the usual course requirements that you have to choose a particular concentration and just stick to that concentration. I said, I want to study whatever I want. And so that way I can find what is the deepest knowledge. So they said, well, actually, this is what your proposal is what the university is actually meant for. We wish, when we were students, that we had the courage to approach things in that way. But as you know, they explained, the world is bound up with questions of financial gain and prestige. You become a Yale graduate, you don't look for a job, the jobs come looking for you. Wall Street, you know, government consultancy, all these things are easily available. But you are choosing wisdom, all right? We will support you. So they told me, in my case, we throw away all the requirements that you have to take one English course, one foreign language, one science course, one mathematics course, so on and so forth. We throw that all away. You can study whatever you want, and at the end of 4 years, we'll call it some kind of major. So they were very supportive. They said, this is actually what the university is meant for. So I studied so many different things, looking for the solution. But again and again, I saw the problem that we're up against. We're up against the problem of low human consciousness. You can change the political system. You can change the economic system. But if the consciousness of the human beings remains unpurified, unuplifted, you're going to just see the same problems again and again. Leading economists are starting to see now that today in the GFC, the global financial crisis, we don't really have an economic problem. We have a moral problem. You see, in the past, economics and morals were closely related. People were concerned, maybe a few hundred years ago. How much is enough? What's the good life? What is cheating? What is exploitation? Those issues are not so popular anymore. Somehow or other, get the money. If you can get the money in a way that's known as legal, okay. Otherwise, do what you can. But you have to get the money so that you can consume. And the more you consume, the more you're happy and the more prestige and social respect you have. So as long as these attitudes rule human society, we'll see no solution. Any solution, regardless of the extraordinary technological development. Because human beings and their consciousness remain so low. I approach this problem from the viewpoint of the ancient yoga texts of India. Because in my studies at Yale, which I just studied so many things, I could see that nothing was working. You have a revolution, you have a government change, put in democracy, put out that, add the free market, or try the opposite, have everything government controlled. Still, because the consciousness remains the same, low. The solution is the same, low. So I myself, upon graduating from Yale, sought out a different kind of knowledge, because I had already studied all the other stuff. I had seen it all. I'd heard the best professors in the world. You see, at Yale, they don't simply have classes where people sit and have you sit in a lecture. The professor sits in the front and lectures. They have what are called seminars, where they invite famous personalities of the world to a seminar with just 12 students present, and you have a chance to interact with those world leaders, world authorities, and you're graded by the professor in terms of your interaction. So I went through that so many times with all the most influential people in the world. Got to ask them questions, and I saw they have no understanding of what the self is. What we're seeing in the world today is a crisis in identity. No one knows who they are. Now, every time I'm speaking at a university, not every time, but a lot of times, I'll ask this question. How many of you, when you filled out your application to attend this university, whether it was online or traditional paper application, how many of you saw the question, can you please tell us who you are, what you are? Never saw that question. Can you please explain what is your identity? It's just fine. Who would dare put such a question on the university application? In other words, what's that got to do with life? Whether I know who I am or not. What's that got to do with success and making the money? It's got nothing to do with that. Even more remote possibility. How many of you saw the question on your application? Can we ask you if you can control your mind and senses? What is that got to do with life? First they ask us, do we know who we are? Then they ask us, can we control our mind and senses? This is crazy. Yes, it is crazy that such questions aren't there. Therefore, how can there be any attempt to uplift humanity when humanity has no clue what its identity is? Of course, you can take a materialistic belief system. Let's hear example. For example, let's hear from someone who's arguably the most famous scientist in the world. Arguably, in terms of popular notoriety. Stephen Hawking. He just tells you point blank what your religion should be. He says, just face it. You're simply chemical scum on a moderate-sized planet. Now, how many of you feel comfortable with that? If you're simply chemical scum, you're just matter, then why should anything matter? Why should chemical scum seek an education? Why should chemical scum seek relationships? And why even worry about the future of chemical scum? So much like dishwater suds. When you're washing your dishes, you know, the suds, you just let them all go down the drain. So similarly, chemical scum, why worry about it? It just all goes down the drain. Or you could say, you were just chemical scum, so let's have a good scummy time while we can. Why worry about future generations of chemical scum? Just do what you feel at every moment. And many people are saying like that. So Mr. Hawking has his belief system that we are just matter. And that belief system could be propagated as being non-sectarian. That belief system could be propagated as being even scientific. Of course, many scientists will point out, this is not science, what he's saying, it's scientism. The fairy tale that physicalism, materialism, has everything figured out. No. Such persons have their beliefs. Let's test them. Let us see. Are we simply matter, or is this something else to us? I'm presenting the ancient science of the supreme as presented, as given in the Vedic knowledge of ancient India. In my travels around the world for over 3-4 decades now, and my studies at the finest university, this year the Hindustan Times in India, which always has a yearly rating of the undergraduate schools in the world, they said Yale is always either number one or number two, this year number one. So I've seen the best. I studied under the best. And I concluded this identity problem is at the root of all the problems. Human beings don't know conclusively, are you matter or are you something non-material? Because if you're non-material, that means you should have non-material goals. And if you're just matter, then nothing matters. So this is the question you have to grab by the horns. You see, let's consider a fairy tale. It's not true, but let's just do a thought experiment and think it's true. Let's think that there is unlimited room in the world for economic expansion. Consumerism can go on exponentially, unlimitedly, and there's no problem in terms of nature. Let's think this fairy tale that you can just expand economies on and on and on. Consumerism can go on increasing and nature can handle all that. Let's assume that fairy tale. And furthermore, not only is there unlimited room for economic expansion, environmentally speaking, but there's also unlimited room for getting rid of waste, because economic expansion produces waste. So it's not simply about consumption, it's also about what to do with the waste from consumption. Okay, let's believe the fairy tale that this unlimited room nature is giving us for all that, for unlimited economic expansion and unlimited waste disposal. It's a fairy tale, but even if it were true, even if the fairy tale were true, and the world could embark on this path of unlimited economic expansion and waste disposal, guess what? Human beings would not be satisfied. That tells us something. It tells us human civilization's on the wrong path. And this message has been presented in the Vedic knowledge since time immemorial. Human beings are meant for enlightenment. They have developed consciousness, and that developed consciousness is not meant for the same things that the animals can get without developed consciousness. So amongst the various different approaches to human problems, I've chosen the ancient spiritual wisdom of India, not because of some sectarian motivation, not because of some nationalistic concern. How could that be? I'm born in New York City. No, I chose it after evaluating all the options. And I can see that this spiritual knowledge based on texts such as Bhagavad Gita, spoken by Krishna, this knowledge can actually help anyone of any calling, of any ethnicity, of any spiritual path. That's what impressed me the most, the universal applicability. Because I certainly wasn't interested in anything sectarian. My family is, at least none of the relatives I know, they're from India. There's probably something somewhere in the family line, but. Why would I choose such knowledge? The decision was based on a thorough evaluation. I was seeking the universal application. And my first concern was, all right, this spiritual wisdom is so deep, but what's it going to do for the problems of the world? That's what I was thinking upon graduation. Now, that was kind of proud and puffed up in me, because what was I doing for the problems of the world? But nevertheless, this was my concern. Oh, this spiritual knowledge, this Krishna knowledge looks very deep. I haven't seen anything as deep as this. But what's it doing for the people of the world who are suffering? How's it relieving exploitation, colonialism, environmental havoc? So once I was convinced that the real problem in the world is low-level human beings with low consciousness, then I understood that techniques for uplifting consciousness, for purifying consciousness, are the need of the day. And now, as I survey the cutting edge of economic literature, I see that the top alternative economists in the US and the UK are coming to the same conclusion. We don't actually have an economic problem. We have a moral problem. It's a moral problem that's afflicting the world. Let's consider, for example, a famous economist who is probably number one in dealing with developing nations, Jeffrey Sachs, who has his Earth Institute at Columbia University in New York. He's a specialist in developing nations, developing economies, but he was so appalled by the situation in the first world that he decided to write an economics book analyzing the USA. And he got so much attention because he's a world-renowned specialist in economies, although particularly economies that are developing. Still, he analyzed the USA, and his conclusion was, we don't have an economic problem in the USA. We have a character problem. What the USA needs is virtue, moderation, compassion, inner awareness. So he was saying this at a press conference announcing his new book. So the reporters asked him, okay, you say, based on your thorough economic analysis, that we don't really have an economic problem. We have a virtue problem, a character problem. We lack moderation, we lack compassion, we lack self-satisfaction. Okay, great. Can you please tell us, where do we go to get that? His response, hey, that's not my department, I'm an economist. He was honest. So this is what is the cutting edge now. How are people going to develop moderation? That's another word, another way of saying sense control. We don't want to use those yogic terms of sense control and mind control. Better to say moderation. Where are they going to learn that from? Are we going to learn it in a secular way? Okay, show us where that's happening, please. Are we going to learn it in a spiritual way? Okay, show us where that's happening. This is the playing field now of the biggest tournament in the world. What to do about people's uncontrolled wants? You see, the problem is not so much needs, but wants. People can't discriminate between needs and wants. Just put yourself in those shoes. Think hard. I want it. You want things so badly, I need it. You can't discriminate between the two. That kind of consciousness is the result of a consumerist society devoid of spiritual knowledge. People cannot discriminate between wants and needs because of uncontrolled mind and senses. The mind and senses are uncontrolled because there's no clear conception of what the self is. Are you matter or are you spirit? This is not just a question for idle persons who like to meditate and contemplate. This is the most practical question. Are we material or are we non-material in terms of our essential being? If I had more time, another occasion, I would explain cutting edge information pointing to our non-material identity. In terms of reincarnation research done at very respectable universities, in terms of near-death experiences, for example, right now in the USA, there's a best-selling book written by a neuroscientist from Harvard. He has been famous as an NDE denier. All those near-death experiences are just all caused by oxygen deprivation. Simply hallucinations caused by a brain that's starved of oxygen. There's no scientific backup for what he's saying, but in other words, he was saying, look, there's got to be a material cause. It can't be that consciousness can operate when all the symptoms of life as measured by scientific instruments are zero. How can it be the person's pronounced brain dead? The heart has stopped, and yet somehow the person revives and can tell exactly what was going on in the operating room, even though all the surgeons have determined this person is clinically dead. Yet somehow the person survives after being pronounced clinically dead and can describe what was going on in the operating theater from a vantage point above. And the person doesn't have a medical background, so the person can't make up all this stuff. So this Harvard neuroscientist was opposed for so many years. There's got to be an ordinary explanation. In other words, there has to be a physical explanation. Because there's nothing else but physicalism. He denied it. Until, guess what? He had a near-death experience. So now he's written a best-selling book recanting. Oh, there must be something non-material. I know, it happened to me. I had a near-death experience in which all my medical symptoms said clinically dead, and yet I was conscious, and I could tell you exactly what was going on in the operating room. So these are some of the areas of research that are challenging the physicalist or materialist conclusion. And it's very important for us to challenge that conclusion individually and collectively if we're going to make a difference in the world. Because if we're simply matter, then it doesn't matter. We can be as greedy as we want. We can be as materialistic as we want. And you see, that's exactly what's happened. With the material conception of life, people are destroying their own habitat, something that animals don't even do. So therefore, in my travels around the world, what I advocate is the spiritual solution. I, myself, in particular, advocate the spiritual solution known as Krishna consciousness, based on the ancient Vedic texts. But we're willing to work with anyone who is pushing the non-material identity of the human being as the reality. Because if you're non-material, it means you have other needs than material. You have needs that can't be satisfied by the economy. And in that way, understanding your non-material identity, you'll reduce your ecological impact. Because you'll be spending a lot of time and energy fulfilling your non-material needs. The strain on the earth will be lessened. And there's so many other benefits from focusing on a non-material identity. The pleasures of the non-material self don't have to be purchased. So that has great economic ramifications. That there is luxury in life that you can't buy, but you can have it without money though. So those are some points I'd like to leave you with today. I'll just stop here in case maybe there are some questions. covered a lot of topics. Yes?
The state of the problem is low-level consciousness. So how do we evolve to higher-level consciousness?
He's saying that I said the problem is low-level consciousness, so how do we attain higher-level consciousness? We need a different kind of technology. I myself espouse a spiritual technology based on the Vedic texts of India, because in my own analysis of everything that's out there in the world, I haven't found anything deeper and more comprehensive. But in any case, as I said, I am advocating a unity amongst all spiritual paths, a unity for highlighting our non-material identity, our non-material needs. So there are various techniques that each spiritual tradition can bring to the table. But we need to consider those techniques seriously. And in this way, we can actually have a chance to uplift human beings. I especially recommend the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra, the Krishna conscious techniques. If someone has other techniques that are actually bringing about an awareness that you're not the body, that you're not the mind, that you are a particle of indestructible spiritual consciousness, if someone else has techniques that will bring about that preliminary understanding, so be it.
Spaces like the ants get extinguished from this planet, and there will be disbalance. How's it? The lower species. You mentioned that apart from human being, if the ants,
if any other, he's asking. I mentioned that if any species is wiped out, it causes major environmental ramifications. Any species except human beings. You can take all the human beings out and nature has no problem. And in fact, these days you can see you take all the human beings out and nature will rejoice. Forests can regenerate, oceans can replenish with fish. Bodies of water will become unpolluted, the air will become unpolluted. So, you were asking about that?
Yes. You mentioned if other species become they vanish, then there will be disbalance.
There'll be what?
Disbalance.
Yes, yes. So, as biologists see it, there will be some major disturbance. Now, an uneducated human being might say, well, what's the big disturbance? Just because a particular kind of ant is wiped out. But someone who's trained, academically trained, a scientist, will see, no. You're not educated. You don't understand that this is causing problems. So you're dealing with scientific perception, and this is given by someone who's considered the most eminent biologist of the 20th century, E.O. Wilson, Harvard Emeritus. Yeah. Human beings, if you vanish all the human beings, nature gets better. So I explain how you can take all the human beings in terms of biomass and log stack them. Pack them like sardines into a box 1.3 cubic miles. And lower that box into just one remote part of the Grand Canyon. Gone. That's how significant human beings are in terms of biomass, physicalism. Any other questions? Yes? Please speak loudly. Okay. Thank you.
I'm considering unity in altruism communities.
in
altruism, economics.
Yes.
However, I made research about I look for books, you know, some books, some research papers, and I didn't find any documents on that topic. And I think about altruism, economics would be an alternative to our current capital system. And I'd like to know if there are somewhere in the world, if, I don't know, a university teaching things like that.
Oh yes, altruism is very much studied because the debate is, is altruism something that has come about through evolution? As simply something, an adaptation for the survival of the species? Or is altruism something else? So yes, there's a debate going on. Because if you're an evolutionist, you have to show how everything comes from evolution. And that includes consciousness. It's a tough one. If you're a non-evolutionist, then you point to the existence of altruism as a non-material quality of a non-material self. So yes, there are battles on this subject, and there are studies of that. You have to turn to the growing alternative economics in the USA and the UK to deal with your subject. There, only at the top universities would there be courses. If you're considering a PhD, you'd have to tap into advanced graduate work in this area. And this is the cutting edge now in economics, because the first world realizes the game's over. There's not enough for everyone if the world keeps living the way it lives. And it has shown no indication it's going to change. So something's got to give. So yes, at the advanced graduate level, you'll find this discussion going on about altruism. How is it that human beings become altruistic? How to further motivate that? And then, of course, a spiritualist like me will say, is there a genuine, lasting material motivation to altruism, or should we switch to the spiritual platform and approach altruism in that way? Very nice question, thank you.
You said that in spiritual thoughts, the human problem. So how do you become spiritual?
We become spiritual to solve human problems by first understanding whether we are the body or we are a non-material entity. That's the first step, the first non-sectarian universal step in becoming spiritual. From there, we can move on. Then we have to understand what is the ultimate source of everything. And we should have discussion, universal discussion about these points. Such discussions are not just the province of one particular spiritual path, this particular spiritual group, or the physicalist scientist. We should have a universal across the board discussion. What is the identity of the human being? And we should consider all the evidence. That includes reincarnation evidence, done at the University of Virginia, for example, evidence so persuasive that the AMA, the most conservative group in the USA, is the doctors group. They looked at the reincarnation research done at the University of Virginia and said, we can't say anything, it's impeccable. In other words, we're not going to embrace the conclusion, but we can't criticize this research, it's impeccable. So we should put that on the table. Let's put the near-death experience evidence on the table. Let's put the whole battle of consciousness. What is consciousness? How did it develop? did consciousness evolve from matter? Is consciousness just an illusion? We don't really have it? Is consciousness produced by the brain? That's also a major part of the discussion. So we need to have a universal discussion, a universal examination of these issues. That's what our Krishna Conscious Society is advocating. We're not just pushing some sectarian approach. We believe this. What do you believe? Do you believe all right? That's not what we're about. We're advocating a universal, across the board discussion of these issues. Let everyone bring their best to the table. You say we're just matter? We're just chemical scum? Bring that to the table. Bring the evidence supporting it. Let's discuss. Yes? Altruism on the spiritual platform means if you're non-material, I should, if I want to benefit you truly, help elevate your understanding of your non-material identity. Now, just be, for example, let's say Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, right in the beginning, that your identity is spirit, soul, and you're wearing the body, just like someone wears clothes. You're wearing the body and mind as external garments. Now, suppose I got a physical problem, and I go to a doctor, and the doctor heals my physical problem. I won't simply say, thanks, but no thanks, because actually I'm not the body, so what does it matter? I'll be very thankful for the doctor solving my mechanical problem, but I won't think the doctor has solved my ultimate problems in life. That's the difference. There's different levels of altruism, okay? Especially if the doctor was free, and there are not too many of those in the USA. The saying in the USA is that America has the best medical system in the world for those who can afford it. So, if any of you are planning to be doctors, well, you want to make some money, there's where you go. Now, there are different levels of altruism. There can be material altruism. If I'm hungry, you give me some food, I'll be grateful. But still, you haven't solved my real problems in life. What am I? Why am I in this world? Where did I come from? Where am I going? So that is the highest altruism, the best altruism, the altruism with impact. So this is what Krishna is recommending in Bhagavad Gita. Be altruistic, certainly, but understand the real impact that genuine altruism gives. Genuine altruism meaning that which actually helps the individual based on what the individual is. If I get a tear in my clothing and you sew it because you know how to sew, I'll be grateful, but I won't think you've really solved my essential issues. So the different types of altruism, there's altruism based on the body, altruism based on the mind. Just like if your car is broken, you go to an auto mechanic. Body's broken, you go to a body mechanic. Mind's broken, you go to a mind mechanic. But you're not the body or the mind, and you're not the car, of course. So real altruism is in terms of aiding someone's spiritual development. So that is what Krishna consciousness is about, and this is why I recommend the universal knowledge and information given in the Krishna conscious text, as well as the spiritual technologies that Krishna gives in Bhagavad Gita. So I thank you all very much for your kind attention.